Hi, and welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard with the stories behind history's greatest rock and roll bands.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Today in the studio, it's the ultimate gift for that rocker on your holiday list to fill their stockings with joy and come down their chimney. The 4-CD Heavy Metal Box.
If you're fortunate enough to be successful as Priest is, then you get to go into the real big arenas where, to our feeling, metal really comes into its own because you're able to put on this larger-than-life show. I mean, metal has always been a loud, a big, explosive type of music, It's only natural to surround it with big physical attributes like stage sets and hundreds of lights and explosions and bombs and smoke.
Get up, everybody!
Probably the process of putting on the makeup is like putting on war paint. You know, all of a sudden you're saying, okay, it's time to stop kidding around. If we know what we know, we knew it back then. We knew it immediately as soon as we started putting the makeup on that we were going to go out there. And it didn't matter if the opening band had a guitar player that played a little faster or the drummer was, you know, we were just going to blow them away, period. And we got thrown off tours consequently, left and right. We were forced to headline.
We were there to do a job. We were there to let everyone know why we were the headliner. And if we weren't the headliner, we were there to let everybody know why we should be.
Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple.
I'm Geddy Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
This is Paul Stanley with the very best of Kiss.
This is Ted Nugent, full time, and we are in the studio.
Hey, this is the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar, in the studio with Redbeard.
Hi, this is Ronnie Montrose in the studio.
It's an endless debate in rock and roll. What was the first heavy metal song? But it's this we know. As early as 1965, the raw materials for forging what would be termed heavy metal music was evident. First, Dave Davis's distorted guitar on the Kinks singles You Really Got Me and All Day and All of the Night. Then, the choppy electric Steppenwolf breakthrough Born to Be Wild. And a chugging cover of Joe South's song Hush by a British quintet called Deep Purple in 1968. For all its impact on American Top 40 radio, Deep Purple's subsequent influence on a generation of heavy metal bands would be even greater in the UK and Europe. Without Deep Purple's 1970 album In Rock, or the benchmark Machine Head 2 years later, would Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, or Def Leppard have sold tens of millions of albums in the 80s? It's doubtful. Arguably, only the original Black Sabbath can equal Deep Purple's seminal importance on heavy music. And Purple indeed made this impact musically, without the macabre, death-obsessed lyrics that later mutated heavy metal into caricature. But it turns out that Deep Purple, at least live, has always been more extemporaneous, like the Allman Brothers Band and the Grateful Dead, according to Deep Purple lead singer Ian Gillan and bass player Roger Glover.
It's really interesting that when we first came into the States, we noticed, actually even before that, when we first became aware of American bands in England, the one staggering difference between the approach to stage performance and American bands and English bands was that they actually rehearsed, and they came with this sort of, you know, they knew what was coming next, and they knew what they were going to do, and they knew where the solos were and everything else. It was really incredible. And of course we never do.
Oh, come on now.
No, quite seriously, there is a framework for the song.
Roger, you're shaking your head.
I'm agreeing with you.
In agreement.
There's a framework for the songs insofar as the words are mostly the same most nights. And after a couple of verses and a chorus, generally there's a guitar solo. But you never really know quite what's going to happen. I don't think any two shows have been the same since we started.
As a matter of fact, I've got a bootleg of Highway Star where you're talking about Mickey Mouse.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that was the original theme of the song.
Like a driver power, big bang.
originally on Deep Purple's 1972 landmark Machine Head album, that's Highway Star, on the heavy metal box. No doubt, three of the Machine Head albums were purchased in 1972 by three Toronto teenagers in a garage band. Like most garage bands, Rush began with another name and a different lineup. The Projection, as they first called themselves, had Gary Weinrib on bass and vocals, John Rutsey on drums, and Alex Zivo Janovich on guitar. Weinrib chose to go with his nickname Getty and his middle name Lee for a stage moniker, and Alex, the guitar player, mercifully adopted Lifeson for a surname, lest DJs everywhere outside of Poland risk dislocating their tongues trying to pronounce the family name. Getty Lee, the son of Holocaust survivors who, through God's grace, were able to build a life after emigrating to Toronto following liberation, recalls Rush's humble beginning.
I think we're very typically suburban. What you'd call, you know, weekend warriors kind of thing. We were growing our hair, and by virtue of the fact that we were growing our hair long, we became sort of in that club of rebels, I guess. Is the best way to describe it. I think we longed to break out of the boring surrounding of the suburbs and the endless similarities and the the houses after houses after houses that were the same, no trees, and you know what I'm saying, and the shopping plazas and all that stuff. And our way, I guess, of trying to be different and not wanting to conform was by growing our hair long. And this music that we were into sort of spoke to us in a way that was a vehicle for us to speak out against whatever you speak out against when you're a teenager. I mean, you know, that's part of teenage life is going through all these hormonal and psychological changes that you don't even know what you're doing half the time. I would describe us as, you know, the kind of kids that we were growing our hair, we were playing in a band, we thought we were kind of hip, I guess we thought we were kind of cooler than the next guy, but we probably weren't.
Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson reminds us that heavy metal may be hormonal, but it's also surprisingly innocent.
Well, to a great degree, you try to hold on to that innocence, that the quality of innocence, because it's attached to spontaneity and in that innate instinctiveness that people have. And certainly when you're a musician or an artist or whatever, it's important to keep a portion of that as part of your character makeup. I think as you get older, certainly the innocence does slip away. The reality of growing changes, everything around you changes. Your whole perspective on the way you view things changes. I mean, physically, it changes. You don't look at things the same way as you did when you were in your teens or your 20s or whatever. Every year, there's a change in the way you see things. Musically, I think it's really important to try to keep a finger on that pulse and not lose it completely.
I'm gonna make it.
Originally on their 1974 debut, that's Working Man from Rush on the Heavy Metal Box. Later this hour, we'll be invaded by the Motor City Madman, Ted Nugent, Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons of Kiss, Sammy Hagar, and the coming up next, Rob Halford of Judas Priest, plus the one and only Alice Cooper, next in the studio. Welcome back to part one of the Ultimate Heavy Metal Box. I'm Redbeard. Vincent Furnier was a preacher's son, born in Detroit, raised in the suburbs of Phoenix, Arizona. A bright boy, not at all inclined to put on his mother's makeup or chase neighbor kids with a meat cleaver. So who would have guessed that Vincent would grow up to become Alice Cooper? Indeed, he did, creating one of the most outlandish characters rock and roll audiences have ever seen. Alice Cooper is the true father of shock rock. Alice Cooper's fifth album, Billion Dollar Babies, is, and I quote, the group's climax of sorts and one of the best rock and roll records of all time. In its own way, it's up there with London Calling by The Clash, Nevermind from Nirvana, and The Beatles' Revolver, contends New Times writer Brian Smith in the liner notes of the Billion Dollar Babies Deluxe Anniversary Edition. Alice Cooper spawned progeny from Kiss to Johnny Rotten, Motley Crue to Marilyn Manson. But unlike many who followed in his wake, Alice Cooper's appeal wasn't solely based on flash pots and fake blood. Snakes and guillotines aside, Alice Cooper has been responsible for some of the 70s' most enduring hard rock anthems. The album, Billion Dollar Babies, perched at number one in the U.S. and the U.K., and as writer Brian Smith reminds us, and I quote, the Alice Cooper group was giving life to the grand pop star myth because they had to. It was their job.
I think it's because we were such a shock to the nation, image-wise. We were sort of like, I always say that we were the band that drove the stake through the heart of the love generation. Everybody was so tired of peace and love and, you know, that kind of San Francisco thing that all of a sudden here was this breath of fresh air. Everything that the hippies didn't believe in, it was like, you know, suddenly there was Clockwork Orange. Alice Cooper was like celebrating sexuality and androgyny and horror and all of this put together, and it was fun. For the first time in a long time, music was not political, it was fun. And Alice Cooper was sort of like the biggest juvenile delinquent rock and roll horror show of all time, and people sat there and said, it's about time that something like this came along. But not only the image was there, the most important thing in our mind was the fact that the music has to stand up years from now. It has to stand up even after they forgot what we did on stage.
Thank you.
everybody loved it. Even people that hated Alice Cooper loved the record. So there was no way of stopping it, and there was so much fun to talk about on the radio, this Alice character. And the press wouldn't leave Alice alone. And so, I mean, we weren't just in Rolling Stone. We were in Time. We were on the cover of Forbes magazine. And so, like, it was the whole world was obsessed with this character. They were going, who is this guy? And is he smart? Is he stupid? Is he, like, from heaven, from hell? Where is he from? And why does he keep contradicting everything that we think is right? And, you know, no matter what it was fun. Alice Cooper was fun.
Hard rock and English band Judas Priest hailed from the blue-collar British steel factory city of Birmingham in the Midlands. They followed a trail blazed by fellow Birmingham band Black Sabbath, but by the early 1980s, Judas Priest had paved that path into a highway for countless other hard rock bands to follow. However, unlike Black Sabbath, Judas Priest's sound didn't bludgeon the listener. Priest's metal blade was far from dull, instead slicing through the metal morass with surgical precision. Yet it took five studio albums and the entire 70s decade to get it right. Few of the music critics who initially dismissed Judas Priest back then were even around to write about Priest's multi-platinum international success in the 1980s, according to Judas Priest lead singer Rob Halford.
I think it's fair to say that the two sides of the Atlantic hold two different opportunities for any band, especially in metal, because here in America, if you're fortunate enough to be successful as Priest is, then you get to go into the real big arenas where, to our feeling, metal really comes into its own because you're able to put on this larger-than-life show. I mean, metal has always been a loud, a big, explosive type of music, It's only natural to surround it with big physical attributes like stage sets and hundreds of lights and explosions and bombs and smoke. So, of course, we have the great opportunity to do that more or less exclusively in America. In Europe, the venues aren't really as accommodating for the type of shows that we're able to do. But having said that, I mean, it's not really fair to say which place is better than another. I think they all have something special and something different and very unique to offer to us as a band. But I think if you push me into a corner, we'd have to say that America is our favourite place to perform, mainly because it's a lot of it is the attitude of the audience. European audiences have a tendency to be a little bit analytical.
Really?
And picky, you
really?
Know. But yeah, I think it's fair to say that. No, I think that most audiences would agree with me, unless it's an English metal maniac in Dallas at the moment waiting for me as I leave the building. But no, I think we like the spontaneity, we like the atmosphere, the attitude, the great feeling that exists at all of the Priest concerts. It's just a great, fantastic party attitude, and people go for a good time, and that's special, you know.
Ah!
Originally on 1982's Screaming for Vengeance, that's Judas Priest with You've Got Another Thing Coming. Now included on the 4-CD Ultimate Heavy Metal Box. Next, Ronnie Montrose and Sammy Hagar, Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons of Kiss, and in a heavy metal rant you have to hear to believe, the great Gonzo himself, Ted Nugent, next in the studio.
This is Paul Stanley with the very best of Kiss.
This is Ted Nugent, full-time, and we are in the studio.
Hey, this is the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar, in the studio with Red Beard.
Hi, this is Ronnie Montrose, in the studio.
Thanks, everybody. Rick Ocasek of the Cars once surprised me with his theory on why their debut holds up so well after all these years. Ocasek said it's because they weren't very good musicians when they made that first Cars album. There's a case to be made for that theory, from Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix, to the first Van Halen album, to the debut from Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction. But nowhere is it more clearly evident than on the 1973 hard rock classic Montrose, bearing the surname of guitarist Ronnie Montrose.
Yeah, and I think one of the basic things that really helped that really pushed the Montrose album, which I think pushes a lot of new albums today, as a matter of fact, is that when you have a limited knowledge, which I certainly did at the time, of chord structure and of musical changes, you have a limited vocabulary, you want to make the words that you do know, you want to make them count. And so when you don't have a vocabulary musically that will allow you to make an elaborate statement, you make your statements direct, concise, and to the point. And I think the first Montrose album musically does that, which is just raw, you know, energy, but with absolute intention, enthusiasm, and everything that goes along with making a statement for the world to hear with what resources you have to use.
Montrose lead singer and songwriter, Sammy Hagar.
It's just as bizarre as how I got in Van Halen. It's the same thing. It just popped up. I was doing nothing. I mean, I had a band, and we were like a club hardcore funk band, you know, Tower of Power, James Brown, Joe Tex, Sam and Dave, R&B stuff. And I was singing and playing guitar with a keyboard player and a bass player and a drummer in a club. And I had written Bad Motor Scooter, Make It Last, One Thing on My Mind, I Don't Want It. I had those four songs, and they're the first songs I ever wrote in my life. And the band hated them because they were rock and roll. I would say, no, I want to be rock and roll. I want to be more like the Stones and more like David Bowie at that time, who had just come out, and Alice Cooper. And these guys are going, oh, man, we hate that crap. And I said, okay. And I took them to Winterland. I said, let's go. I want to show you guys what kind of band I want to have. And Edgar Wintergroup was playing. Ronnie Montrose is in the band. And Edgar Wintergroup was kind of a rock and roll funk band, because he had come from White Trash, which these guys dug White Trash. So I was thinking, well, I get him through the back door, you know, introduce him to Edgar. So I didn't know Edgar, but I'm saying to that kind of music. So we go to Winterland, we're in the audience, and Ronnie Montrose blew my mind. He was like totally Mr. High Energy, Mr. Metal guitar rock and roll hero to me. And the next day I was bragging about how great he was, and some guy goes, I know Ronnie, man. He lives, you know, just, you know, a couple miles from here, and he just quit. That was his last gig with Edgar Winter. He's looking for a singer, wants to start a band. I went, I'm there, dude, Beavis and Butthead style. And I got the guy to take me to his house, and I actually, you know, basically knocked on the door and said, hey, you looking for a singer? He said, yeah. He said, you got any songs? I said, yeah. And I played him those songs, and he shook hands, said, you know a good drummer? I said, yeah. And I took him to show him Denny Carmassi. And we got Denny, and he had Bill Church. We had a band that had a record out in about 4 months. We were on tour. Just from nothing to everything. And really was amazing.
Yeah.
An absolute benchmark in the evolution of heavy metal, that's Bad Motor Scooter on the first Montrose album in 1973, written and sung by Sammy Hagar with Ronnie Montrose on guitar, part of the Heavy Metal Box. That same year, a New York City-based quartet released the first of three albums in only 18 months. Here's a rock and roll wager for you. I bet that several of the DJs at this rock station you're listening to right now saw Kiss as their first rock and roll arena show ever. You know that old saying about you never forget your first romantic kiss? It should probably be updated for an entire generation to be, you never, ever forget your first Kiss concert. But to quote writers Stephen Erlewine and Greg Prado in the All Music Guide, Kiss's music shouldn't be dismissed. It's a commercially potent mix of anthemic, fist-pounding hard rock driven by sleek hooks and ballads powered by loud guitars, cloying melodies, and sweeping strings. It was, they remind us, a sound that laid the groundwork for both arena rock and the pop metal that dominated the late 80s, end quote. So how did the Kiss concept get created in the first place? That place where the fantasy world of comic book heroes and demons meets the decibel-driven reality of a loud electric guitar? Kiss bass player Gene Simmons goes first, followed by singer, rhythm guitarist Paul Stanley. Here's Gene.
You know, it's a really good question. I can remember we got out of the club days and had our first, quote, arena show. It was in New York City at a place called the Academy of Music, and we were fourth on the bill. It was New Year's Eve, and it was Kiss opening the show before our first album came out, and then a group called Teenage Lust, a local popular band, and Iggy Pop, and then Blue Oyster Cult. And we only played for 30 minutes. But, you know, we never used to have pep talks before the show. I've seen other bands where they put their hands together and pray or do sort of football huddles. And I tell you what, we must have been delusional back then and continue to be, because there's always a sense, you know, killers, I don't think, sit around saying, okay, let's go kill some fresh meat. But there was clearly the predator in all of us. Come to think of it, probably the process of putting on the makeup is like putting on war paint. You know, all of a sudden you're saying, okay, it's time to stop kidding around. If we know what we know, we knew it back then. We knew it immediately as soon as we started putting the makeup on that we were going to go out there. And it didn't matter if the opening band had a guitar player that played a little faster or the drummer was, you know, we were just going to blow them away, period. And we got thrown off tours consequently, left and right. We were forced to headline.
We had a great appreciation for other bands. Matter of fact, a lot of the bands who used to open up for us were bands that we were fans of. However, as much as we loved some of those bands or appreciated what they were doing, the love fest ended when we hit the stage, because we were there to destroy them. And it had nothing to do with how much we appreciated what they were doing or whether we were fans of theirs. We were there to do a job. We were there to let everyone know why we were the headliner. And if we weren't the headliner, we were there to let everybody know why we should be.
I'm not afraid of the dark.
Kiss from 1976 and Destroyer with Detroit Rock City on the Heavy Metal Box. But there's only one worthy of the nickname the Motor City Madman, and that's the great gonzo, Tyrannosaurus Ted Nugent. This heavy metal rant occurred after Ted had just performed a two-hour concert in 105-degree heat. And remember, folks, absolutely no drugs, just high on rock and roll.
That good, clean, fun red beard are what?
Jeez, you can't keep a good dog off your leg, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely.
What a nice boy that is. This was recorded right off in the inception of the tour, Red Beard. We started off in the Midwest, and we did a little pre-lubrication, get down, yaha, rock and roll, boogie woogie tour in April, because me and the boys would be breathing fire and romping and stomping and chomping a bit like a bunch of young pups, you know, on the prowl of a young hot raccoon. And we went out on the road, and we did 26, Red Beard, count them, 26 cities in 29 days.
That all, I mean, huh?
This was your basic roadie killer tour. You know, anybody who died wasn't allowed to come with us on the summer tour, you know. So we went out in April and we just rocked our little brains loose, you know. Chaos. Sheer chaos. Not as good as tonight, though, man. Tonight.
Tell me about tonight.
Tonight was the cat's ass, man. What a riot that was. I haven't had that much time, man, till I was breathing through my spine one night because I was over-wangled, you know. Realized, man, me and the boys, we just kind of come off the road in 1979. I mean, we was rocking our little wee brains loose just to dragging them on the cement, you know, to the flesh was behind us, and there was a path. There was a path burnt in the highway, basically my way, as we went cruising down the byway, skyway. And anyhow, what we do is we get on the almighty highway, man. We just burn, you know what I mean? We just kind of cruise for a bruise. And we did such an intense summer tour through 1979 and through into the fall of 1979. Then, of course, come September 1979, as I do every year, man, I lay down the guitar and pick up my Smith & Wesson, and I head into the woods. You know, I go out and I hunt for 4, 5, 6 months a year. And during this hunting time, I get very relaxed. However, in the pursuit of relaxation, gyration, celebration, regurgitation, sensations, me and the boys get together and we go and we have this malady that strikes us called having your cake and eating it too. All right. So when you got frosting on the frosting and you got cake all over your face from grinning, a bad case of the almighty grin, we went into the studio fresh from the tour when we, you know, rocking out every night, and we went in. We went to these little rock and roll clubs in the Midwest. And we'd walk into a couple hundred people, and we'd get up on stage, and we'd disarm the local band, and we'd start a yanking and a cranking, man. We'd start jamming. And that's where all these rhythm patterns come from. And you just plug into the amp, and all of a sudden, baggle, gaggle, 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 oh, my baby, she loves rock. And you start singing about twisting your legs through the hemisphere, you know. And hey. Hey, you can't keep a young pup off the kneecap, you know. So we just blast forth with these rock and roll rhythm patterns, you know. Just like Young Cruisers, you know, which rock and roll is all about living it up, boogie woogie nonstop kind of a thing, you know. Especially personified Redbeard in this amazing song that goes. Sometimes you gotta take your baby in your arms and you gotta say, baby, I just need me a little violent love.
Ted Nugent's Cat Scratch Fever, now included as part of the 4-disc heavy metal box. But that's only half the story. Next week in Part 2, we'll have Queensryche's Jeff Tate and Chris DeGarmo, Klaus Meine and Rudolf Schenker of Scorpions, David Coverdale from Whitesnake, Living Color's Vernon Reid, James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett from Metallica, and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Ozzy Osbourne, all in the studio for Part 2 of the Heavy Metal Box. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.